structure in Old Testament history, here's where I want you to start thinking about this instruction. The way a thing is built tells you a lot about what it is all about, doesn't it? The way a thing is built tells you a lot about its purpose. For example, what is a castle for?
Protection.
A protection, yeah. Yeah, I felt like I needed to send my wife a selfie standing outside this building, you know, put some armor on, stand outside these big stone walls. It's amazing. So let's say a castle is for defense. What is a cathedral? The purpose of a cathedral? Yeah, a cathedral is worship. You can tell a lot about a thing by the way it's built is what I'm working on here. What is a cottage for? It's a home, yeah. Cottage is a dwelling. So we're working on this notion of structure. My claim is you can tell a lot about a thing and its purpose based on how it's built. All right? What? It's the brand new Simeon Trust. We're going to show up with actual line drawings. What features, okay, you can tell a lot about what a thing is for, what a thing is about, based on how it's built. What features of a castle tell you that it's about defense? There's a drawbridge. High walls. Real narrow windows. Yeah, big thick stone walls. All right, what features... the way a cathedral's built, tell you that it's for worship. Really high ceilings, yeah.
Stained glass.
Stained glass. And usually glass that's up high, right? Yeah, shape of a cross. All of these things that are meant to draw your gaze upward. And a cottage is a dwelling. It's a place where people gather. Its function is to sustain and house life. What features of a cottage convey that? Okay, yeah, there's a chimney, there's a hearth, there's a gathering place, something that keeps people warm. There's more going on in a cottage as well. You can tell what each building is about by the way it's built. Same with literature. You can tell what a work of literature is about by the way it's built. Structure reveals emphasis. Here's how the principle is stated in the Simeon Trust. We must discover the structure of a passage and that's not the end of the principle. We must discover the structure of a passage in order to discern its emphasis. That's what we're after. Somebody grab your worksheet. Doesn't have to be a finished one, just grab a worksheet. We must discover the structure of a passage to discern its emphasis. Structure is probably a word you've heard in the past, whether you've been to a Simeon Trust workshop or not. Literary works have an inherent structure to them. But read to me the question for number one on the worksheet. Somebody read it to me, good and loud.
How has the author organized this passage?
Okay, keep going.
Please show the structure of
sections
of first references. Okay. What is the emphasis revealed by?
So several parts to that question. All of them are inherent to the process and then the payoff of finding structure. But structure is not an end in itself. Please show the text portions with verses. And then where it ends is how that structure reveals an emphasis. All right? Let me illustrate with a diagram. I have to change metaphor from construction to the one that we use in the Simeon Trust. The reason we use a skeleton is the structure of a work of architecture is usually a little more plain. But the structure of a text is hidden, and you have to have these x-ray eyes to see what's going on in there. You can find it. You just have to look around for it. Now, what we're looking for is the structure, but that's not an end in itself. It reveals emphasis, the thing this text is about based on how it's built. Remember? A castle is about defense, and a cathedral is about worship, and a cottage is about a dwelling based on how it's built. Same with literary texts. You can tell what they're about based on how they're built. Let me give you some problems that show up a lot when guys are doing structure work and trying to name their emphasis. Sometimes we get a full summary sentence. Like, if this is the text and that's the structure, somebody might go, the emphasis of that structure is an arrangement of human bones standing upright facing away from the viewer. Bro. Or you could go, hey, tell me the emphasis of a castle. What's a castle all about? A castle is a stout arrangement of quarried stones with narrow slits in between. Bro, a castle's about defense. The structure reveals that emphasis, not a full summary sentence. So, and we'll explain why in a moment this matters. One of the other common mistakes is a list of ideas. That's not actually an emphasis either. If we want to use our skeleton illustration, somebody could try to state the emphasis of that structure by saying skull, clavicle, spine, femurs. Simply listing the ideas isn't structure. You're after relationships. How are they put together? And here's another common error in structure when people are trying to name the emphasis. They'll just name a single feature. And in that case, they'd be like, hey, this text is about a skull. You know, they see like some evidence of God's sovereignty in the passage and they just go, oh, I'm talking about that thing. And that's not the emphasis either based on the structure. So it's not just a disorganized like pile of bones, and it's not an abstract description of the bones, and it's not just a single feature here, it's the arrangement of all of these things, how they are actually put together. That's what we're after, trying to find out how the organization, the way the thing's structured, reveals a particular emphasis, and let me just show you why that matters. On the pathway, we have for question one, structure which is part of exegesis and helps us get from the world of the text to them then, right? And the outcome of finding structure yields what? Gives you an emphasis. So your answer to question one is then going to take you through context to what's question three asking? Somebody read that for me.
What is the main point the author is arguing to his audience in one short sentence?
The author's main point is going to be a direct derivative of the emphasis. So if you find the emphasis of the structure, the emphasis the structure reveals, this text is about, this building is about defense. And then you do a little context work, and then you realize, oh, it's about defense in this place for this reason. And then you have the author's main point. And then what's the question for number five? What's the main point that you will argue to your readers or to your listeners? Your sermon main point. And look at where these appear on the pathway. Structure, question one is here. Author's main point is here. And the sermon main point is somewhere over here. And we're just trying to move you along the pathway in an organic, evolving way. You go through context to get the author's main point. You go through the Christ connection to get the sermon main point. We want you to start with emphasis because that's just the general thing this text is about. Author's main point is what he's saying about that. So there's just this evolutionary process that's happening. All right. Now, here's the thing about structure. Different text types are built different ways, just like different buildings are built different ways. There are three general text types, right? Little literary theory here, all right? Three text types: discourse, poetry, and narrative. For discourse, think, in case you don't know exactly what these mean, think speeches. Poetry, think songs. And a narrative, think stories. And these things are all built different ways. They're built with different tools. I'm just going to lay out for you what those tools are so that we can get into the text. All right? But the biggest bones, back to that skeleton metaphor, the biggest bones of discourse are paragraphs. And this will be important in just a second. Discourse divides into paragraphs. Those are big, self-contained thought units. Poetry divides into stanzas. And narrative divides into scenes. Those are the big bones. Often just looking for those will help you. And we have all three of these text types in Kings, actually. So let me put a tool or two out here and then show you how they work just real quickly before we really drill down on narrative, because that's mostly what's here. We have some discourse in 1 Kings. Those are speeches. Somebody turn, let's all turn to 2 Kings 17. Second Kings 17, starting in verse 7, we have a long speech. Who is this speech by? It's not in quotes, so sometimes you might miss the fact that it's a speech, but this is just an individual explaining something. Yeah, the narrator is just speaking. This is just discourse. Second Kings 17, 7. And one of the main tools used to put a discourse together is logic. Look at this discourse. Just let your eyes run down through this discourse and show me words that show he's making a logical argument. Anywhere in this extended passage. What are argument words, logic words? This occurred because the people of Israel had sinned against the Lord God, their God. I already said one of them. This occurred because the people of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who brought them up. What logic word do you see in there?
Because.
He's building an argument. And so you just follow the logic. Do you see any more of them as you go down through that passage? We're just doing this real quick. And, but. However. Yeah, so this is just a discourse. The main tool used to build discourse is logic. There's actually another one that shows up fairly often. Rhetorical features, and by that I mean like if-then, question and answer, quotation. Look down to verse 12. They did wicked things, provoking the Lord to anger, and served idols, of which the Lord God had said to them, "You shall not do this." A direct quote is a rhetorical feature. It's common in discourse. It's also common in poetry and narrative, but when it happens, notice the author's doing something. with that? How can you tell the emphasis in discourse? You can tell the emphasis by following the argument to its destination. All right, so you just follow, where is this speech going? What's he trying to prove? And most of us work well with discourse. We can handle that. It's a little tougher in poetry. So let me just give you the tools for poetry, because there is some poetry in this book. One of the main tools for poetry is literary devices, like metaphor and simile, personification, parallelism. But one of the most helpful tools for discerning the structure of poetry is shifts between stanzas. Turn to 2 Kings 19. We've got a poem here. First verse of the poem. Who's the subject here? She despises you. She scorns you. The virgin daughter of Zion. She wags her head behind you. The daughters of Jerusalem. Who's the she? Zion. I know you haven't read this for a while. I know I'm just doing this cold. But real quickly, you can notice right at the outset, okay, this is a stanza or a line in this poem where the virgin daughter of Zion is the focus. Now there's a shift. We actually get into another stanza right away. Whom have you mocked and reviled? Against whom have you... Is he talking to the virgin daughter of Zion? Lifted up your eyes on the heights against the Holy One of Israel. By your messengers you have mocked the Lord, and you have said... You can tell who he's speaking to at this point, because if you look back up at the context, verse 20... Thus says the Lord God of Israel, your prayer to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard. So Isaiah speaking to Hezekiah about Assyria. The first stanza is about the virgin daughter of Zion. The second stanza is God quoting the king of Assyria, Sennacherib. Look at it, verse 23. You have said, with my many chariots, I have gone up to the heights of the mountains, to the far recesses of Lebanon. How far does that go, where he's quoting the king of Assyria? Where does the subject change now to focus on someone else's attitude toward what's going on? Yeah, for sure in 27 you notice, but I know you're sitting down. But does the shift actually even happen earlier than that? Yeah, probably 25. Have you not heard I determined it long ago? So you got three stanzas. Virgin daughter of Zion, mocking the king of Assyria. Then the king of Assyria being quoted in a derisive kind of way, and then God saying, here's what I'm going to do. I'm throwing down on you. So those are the big bones in that piece of poetry. We noticed the shifts, and then the emphasis is going to be revealed by, and this is, it almost feels like it goes without saying, but I think it's helpful for me to realize, the emphasis is revealed by the relationship among those stanzas. And this is a progression from Zion's mocking to Assyria's taunts to the Lord's taunt and now promise how he's going to take down Assyria. Okay, there's not a lot of poetry in Kings. We're not going to, I know I went through that quickly. We'll take our time working on narratives. And there are two main tools used to build narratives. There's plot. Well, three actually. Plot. Characters. And then there's sort of this catch-all category that we'll see a few examples of, literary features. That's why I pointed out that narratives are built in scenes. Sometimes it's really helpful to notice scene changes and how those develop. But plot and character are the main construction materials, the main construction schemes for narrative. And so if you can find the plot, you can find the emphasis. Now, we all know how plots work, but sometimes when we're working with a plot, we don't quite, we get hung up like, how does this plot reveal a certain emphasis? Let me just give you a little example of how plots work. That dude is crazy. Oh, bro, you have no idea how crazy that dude is. One time, we were in downtown Philly having Philly cheesesteaks, and he set his cheesesteak down on a brick wall, and he ate a slice of pizza, and a minute later, he picked it up, and cockroaches crawled out, and he ate it. That dude's crazy. Okay, we got a problem, right? That dude's crazy. And some setting stuff and a little rising action, and then the moment of critical tension, he picked up his cheesesteak with cockroaches coming out. How crazy is this cat? He ate it. So the emphasis of a plot is the thing that like resolved the tension. And there are tragedies and comedies. The resolution isn't always positive. Sometimes the guy eats the cockroaches. That's gross as heck. But that's the resolution, right? Everybody's like, is he crazy? Prove he's crazy. Well, let me tell you about this Philly cheesesteak with cockroaches coming out of it. So we'll see this sort of thing. Let me just draw it in for you. So a plot, there's a setting, and then there's some kind of problem that happens. There's rising action. There's a climactic point. This cannot get any more tense. There were cockroaches in his cheesesteak. That's awful. You got to be kidding me. And then this can't get any worse. How's this going to go? And he eats it. Oh my gosh, that dude is crazy. So he ate the cheesesteak with cockroaches. That's how crazy he is. That's the emphasis, the turning point of that tension. All right, let's work on an actual narrative in Kings and do some of this stuff. All right, 1 Kings chapter 3. 16 to 20, 28. I need somebody to read it for me, and as he reads, we are going to look for a significant literary feature. All right? What text type is this, by the way? See how I had you six letters down the road to that word? It's a narrative. And we're going to look for a significant literary feature. Remember, I said plot, character, and literary features. Literary features are like scene changes. Sometimes the narrator will just come out and tell you what to think. That's not a plot point or a characterization. That's just a literary feature, all right? Somebody read 1 Kings 3, 16 to 28, good and loud, and we're going to look for a significant literary feature that will tell us what this story's about, just based on how it's built, all right? Somebody read it good and loud. All right, look at the plot in a minute. What's the problem? When does it climax? What's the resolution? But first, just take the easy, you know, take the low-hanging fruit. I'm not saying if you miss this that you're, you know, not seeing something simple. But as we start pointing these things out, it will get more simple for you. There's a narrator comment here that tells us what this story's about. Do you see it? Verse 28. The point of this narrative is what? Yeah, the wisdom of Solomon. That's a nice, appropriately vague but specific emphasis. It's not a summary sentence. It's not a list of bones. Wisdom of Solomon, that's the thing this story is about. We know that just based on how it's built. The biggest construction feature that we've noticed is a narrator comment. And guys, do not miss these. There are only two characters, two people in the Bible whom you can always trust. Who are they? Number one, I heard somebody say Jesus. Read and reread and Jesus. Those are the two. Okay, yeah, God. He's one of the people in these Old Testament narratives that you can always trust. Who's the other one? The narrator, why? Why can you always trust him? He speaks for God. So you can always trust when the, and a lot of these Old Testament narrative books don't tell us what to think very often. Judges, not a lot of editorial insertions. There are some, right? You get to the end of the book. Samuel, man, you'll pound your head against those narratives looking for, what does the author think? But Kings, they're all over, aren't they? These narrator insertions. What are the common examples in Kings? Yeah. Yes, so-and-so did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord.
Fulfilled the word of the Lord.
Yep, that sort of thing shows up a lot in this book. Don't overlook those. That is gold for doing structure work. Narrator comment. Now, let's work a little bit on the plot. And here's why I really want to drill down on this, because the plots, the narratives in Kings are really complicated. So let's see if we can find the conflict that drives this narrative, the climax. Conflict is what problem drives the story. Climax, what move in the story, what action, comment, event, brings that tension to its peak, at which point it's gonna go one way or the other. It's gonna be a tragedy or a comedy. Tension can't get higher. What's the climax? What's the resolution? The other pieces of a story, of a narrative arc, setting, rising action, the new setting, those also matter, of course, especially in our preaching, but for structure work, it's what problem drives the tension, what is the high point of that tension, and then how exactly did that resolve? So that's why I just want to do these three pieces, all right? Now, again, these narratives in Kings are kind of complicated. What problem drives the story? Well, you just heard the story. What problems appear? A lot of these narratives have multiple problems. So what problems appear in the story? There are a bunch of them. What are they? We got a dead baby. We don't know who is the living baby. What else? Sorry, say it again. They both want the living baby. Somebody's perjuring herself. Solomon has to decide. No witnesses. Okay, we got all sorts of problems. Here's the question, which one of those is actually driving this narrative? And guys, here's the reason that matters. If you misidentify the crisis, you'll probably misidentify the resolution and you'll preach the wrong sermon. So, here's a pro tip, work backwards. Let's just start with resolution. Let's just start there, all right? At what point in the narrative has the problem been solved? At what point has the tension that has us on the edge of our seats, we're on the top of this climbing tension, at what point is that resolved? Things are settled. It's gonna be a comedy or a tragedy. 27, all right. What's in 27? Identification of the true mother. What about 26? Let's just think about 26 for a minute. Then the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because her heart yearned for his son, "Oh my Lord, give her the living child and by no means put him to death." Is that the resolution? What do we know now that we're in verse 26? What do we just learn in verse 26? Who the true mom is, right? So if the resolution is 26, the identity of the true mom, in other words, if the conflict is whose baby, then the resolution is who's the true mom. And we learn that in verse 26. And how do we learn it? The narrator tells us, and she says a thing a true mom would say, right? I would rather you not slice that baby in half if she gets it. Just let her have the, and then what's your sermon? Your sermon is about the sacrificial love of a mother who will give up her child rather than have, right? That's what the story is about. If the conflict that drives the story is whose baby, and the way you can tell whose baby is who gives the most for that baby. Good Mother's Day sermon. The narrator already told us what this story is about. What's it about? The wisdom of Solomon. So the moms are incidental. I mean, they're important, but they're incidental. It could be two farmers with a cow. I mean, it could be, right? Because the point is the wisdom of Solomon, and the narrator already told us that's the point, and we saw it loud and clear in verse 28. So the conflict is not actually whose baby. What's the conflict? How do we know? How does Solomon know? Yeah, how can you determine? Let me just put, does Solomon know? Does Solomon know the mom? Can Solomon identify the true mom? That's why verse 27 is the resolution, not verse 26. Verse 26 is actually the climax, right? Tension is still building in verse 26. How do we know? The true mom speaks, but that's not the end of the tension. What else happens in verse 26? Well, the king has to decree, but there's more tension building in 26 even before he decrees. Yeah, so the king has to decree. We're waiting for that. And while we're waiting, the tension gets higher because the other woman goes, go ahead and kill him. And we know how the story ends, so we're not on the edge of our seat. But imagine, right? You're like, oh, one of the ladies actually said, use that sword and slice him in half. So the tension's still rising. It's at the peak we're feeling max pressure right now, and then this thing resolves and Solomon demonstrates that he knows who the right mom is. That's the point of the story. Now, you're not actually ready to preach. You've got to do context work to figure out why this matters. You've got to connect to Christ. But still, even once we have an emphasis, which is the wisdom of Solomon, we can't just stand up there and go, Solomon was super wise. We need to dwell in the details of the narrative. Let's look at how this author very creatively builds that tension, all right? Let's just think about how this narrative works. This is part of structure. Look at verse 18. What does verse 18 add to the tension? Then on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth and we were alone. There was no one else with us in the house. Only we two were in the house. What does that add to the tension? No eyewitnesses. So when you preach, you let that tension build based on the structure. You point that out. Three times she says there's no witnesses, just different ways. Ordinarily, in a case like this, you bring eyewitnesses and you get eyewitness testimony, and Solomon doesn't have that option. Wow, can he divine, just based on the evidence, the answer to this question? I'm gonna know the right mom. How does verse 21 add to the tension? How does it? Now, notice this narrator doesn't just narrate the action. He puts it in the mouth of the characters. They're all speaking. Verse 21. This is the first woman. How does this add to the tension? When I rose in the morning to nurse my child, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him clearly in the morning, behold, he was not the child I had born. You notice anything funky about how she's speaking? She sounds confused. Yeah. What else do you notice about what she's saying here? Yeah, twice, right? Yeah, and in the morning, behold. In the morning, behold. She does that twice. Which is a demonstration of, I'm not quite sure what, but probably she's frazzled and frantic, and it helps you identify with this character, this author just building tension through the through the words of these characters. How about verses 22 and 23? What wonderful literary structure that Peter Lighthart loves is in verse 22. The other woman said, no, the living child is mine and the dead child is yours. The first said, no, the dead child is yours and the living child is mine. Thus they spoke before the king. What literary structure is that? Dead child is your, living child is mine, dead child is yours. No, dead child is yours, living child is mine. What structure is that? It's a chiasm. These gals are speaking in a chiasm right there. And look what Solomon does, verse 23. Then the king said, this is my son that is alive and your son is dead. And the other says, no, but your son is dead and mine is the living one. He repeats the chiasm. How's that building tension? Look, I'm not looking for some special answer. This is what you do in your study on Monday when you're doing, or Tuesday when you're doing your structure work. You're like, huh, they're speaking in a chiasm, and so is he. I wonder what that's about. And so you enter into the world of the story. What is that about? What's it doing? Yeah, right? It's confusing. There's a stalemate. We're stuck. They're like sing-songing back and forth, and he's quoting them. The author's just building. And so when you preach this, I'm going to do a talk on argument on Friday, but when you preach this, you want to let the listeners sit in the tension. You want to let, and this beautifully crafted work of art to do it. All right. Verse 24, how does that add to the tension? Solomon said, bring me a sword. So a sword was brought before the king. Something's going down. You get the point, right? The that's right, no pun intended. So we might even add to our little emphasis here, not just the wisdom of Solomon, the life and death wisdom of Solomon. Right? This guy can make a decision where someone's life is at stake, and in terms of that mom existentially, there's two lives at stake here. And he can be trusted. And then the narrator says, all Israel heard the judgment the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king because they perceived the wisdom of God was in him to do justice. All of that just demonstrating how plot and literary features, how the story's built, reveal what it's about. It's about the wisdom of Solomon. That's what you preach. You don't preach about the sacrificial love of a mom. I mean, moms sacrificially love their kids. That's just not what this text is about. All right, let's do one more. We don't have as much time to spend on this, but thankfully James got us moving. Let's look at 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 1 through 14. Some stories are driven by plot, and the characters just help move the plot along. Other stories actually are driven by the characters, and you see them develop. So in a plot, the emphasis is, what resolved that tension? That's the emphasis. What resolved the problem? In a character-driven story, or when you're using the character tool, you're looking for what's revealed about this character, and often in their relationship to God. That's the emphasis in a character-driven story. What's revealed about this character, especially in their relationship with God? Now, real quickly, I'm going to have you guys work together in a minute, but just to get, let's work together. I'm going to have you work in partners in a minute. Let's work together to figure out what is the crisis and what's the climax and what's the resolution in this story. All right, we've already all read it, so let's just do this together. What's the problem that drives this narrative? It's in verse 1, it's in verse 3. Yep. Naaman is sick. When is that resolved? Where in the story is that thing resolved? Verse 14, what is the resolution? Naaman's healed. Sweet. What's the climax of this story? Tension can't get any higher. This thing we know now resolves with a healing, but what is it that pushes that rising tension over the hill to a resolution? What is the thing? What's the turning point? Sorry, say it again. Verse 11. Okay, what's in verse 11? What do you see there that feels like the turning point to you? Okay, he's furious. That's pretty high tension, isn't it? He's furious. Does the tension resolve after he's furious? He gets furious and then he's healed. No, that's okay. Remember, we're in spring training. I just hit a fly ball. It fell to the ground. Okay, we're working on this. This is what we do. We do this in our study. There's still rising tension. I do this all the time. I'm like, oh, he gets angry. That can't be, you can't get much more tension than that. But this story actually does, right? Because it's not the anger that resolves into his healing. There's more tension building. What is it? What else happens? Okay, what's there?
So servant's telling him, if he told you to do this big thing, you do it, but you won't do this little thing.
Yeah. The servant says to him, it's a great thing you do it, you won't do this little thing. Or depending on your translation, this is a great thing, just do that. So it is the words of the servant, right? You could put it there too. Yeah, I have zero objection. Who said that? Yeah, right? He obeys and you're like on the edge of your seat wondering, how's this going to go? Is he going to come up out of the water just wet? You know, is this an infant baptism where nothing happened? Or did he just get wet? Or as Michael Lawrence would say, if it didn't happen in the context of a local church, ain't a baptism, right? You got wet at camp. You didn't get baptized. Even for our Baptist brothers, this isn't easy to ferret out, is it? Okay, it could be any one of those things, right? This isn't an exact science. It could be he's in the water. He's going to go down. What is, okay, all right. Now, here's what I want you to do working in partners. I want you to compare a couple of characters, all right? Compare Naaman in verses 1, 11, and 12 with the girl in verses, well, pretty much just verse 2, all right? Talk to your partner. Just notice a couple of points of comparison. See how this helps illuminate the emphasis of the story. All right, what do we got? Pretty simple exercise. What points of comparison do you see? Or is this not actually a comparison, it's something else? It's a contrast here, isn't it? All right, so we're contrasting. And what points of contrast do you see?
Little and mighty.
Little and mighty. What else?
Commander versus servant.
Okay, servant, commander. What else?
Sick
and healed. And talk to me about that. What do you mean by healed? She's just physically well? Okay, sure. He's sick, she's not. Okay? Okay? She's from Israel, he's from Syria. Faith and no faith. Yeah, she has some spiritual insight, doesn't she? I wish you were attached to the prophet. He didn't have any idea that that's an option. Okay, so there's some spiritual sensitivity on her part, some a source of power that she knows of that he doesn't. All right, so virtually in every way, these are polar opposites.
Yeah, the Naaman is ironically listening, and then the little girl is advising.
Oh, interesting. Where do you see that?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this position of information, this information puts her in a position to advise him. Yeah, right. And I would suggest that might be foreshadowing something toward the end of the story, what drives us toward this resolution. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Yeah, where do you see him acting dishonorably? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, these verses here, right, 11 and 12, when he actually speaks, you see that this guy has more than just bad skin. Yeah. Yeah. So again, when the narrator, sorry, keep going. Yes. She wants, she's longing, and he's too proud. Verse 11, behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and do some voodoo. So he's proud. And then verse 12, what else is he? Not just proud. There's two rivers in Damascus that are so much better than this nasty Jordan. He's prejudiced, right? Naaman's got more than bad skin going on. Now, notice as the story concludes, You can look at the change in this character, Naaman. If we just look at verses 14 and 15 and compare him again to the little girl, all right? So do that little exercise with your partners. And these are two verses I don't think we read in exercise with James. Or maybe, yeah, I guess we did read 14. Yeah, go ahead and read 14 and 15 and then compare Naaman to the little girl, the Naaman after the miracle. All right, what points of comparison do you see? Just shout them out. What points of comparison now? This is Naaman after the miracle. How is he actually now similar to the little girl? Okay, where do you see that? Isn't that interesting? His skin became like a little child. And it's actually the same word in Hebrew as the little girl. I don't read Hebrew, but I know enough of Hebrew to. So there's that little girl thing that shows up in English and the little child thing that shows up in English. And you just want to sniff that out and go, is that? Yes. He's become this. Okay, what else? What other comparisons do you see? He says to Elijah, or is it Elisha? He says to Elisha, your servant. And if you keep reading after verse 15, he calls him your servant. He calls himself your servant multiple times. So now he's a servant. What else do you notice?
There's an intermediary the first time he visited Elisha, but he couldn't stand in Elisha's presence, but now he's able to stand in his presence.
Yeah, pretty interesting. And again, these are just data points that you've got to figure out what's the significance of them. I don't know exactly what you do to preach that, but he needed an intermediary. Elisha didn't just go out and perform the miracle. So what would we say is the emphasis based on this plot where Naaman was sick and the servant challenged him and Naaman obeyed and then he was healed? And now we see this contrast between Naaman before and the little girl and Naaman after compared to the little girl. Put all this data together, talk to your partner for 1 minute and come up with an emphasis. Based on plot and character comparison, what's this story about based on how it's structured? All right, and look, I don't want a summary sentence. I don't want a list of ideas. It's about the word of the Lord. It's not a single, all right, give me an emphasis. All right, tell me what you got. Because this is it, and then we need to take questions. Somebody tell me what you guys got for your emphasis. Okay, humility. All right, give me just two sentences to defend that. Okay, Naaman had to become humble in order to be healed. So there's a more full development of it, and you're trying to not give a summary sentence. Nice, it's about humility. We could add more, it doesn't have to just be one sentence, but humility's definitely gotta be part of your answer, right? He becomes the little girl, essentially. Okay, what else? Emphasis. What does humility get for this guy? Okay. Okay. And he, again, with the plot, he had to do something to be transformed. It's not just that he woke up one day transformed. And so you want to include that in your emphasis. Okay. What else? What are our options here? Yeah. Something about grace to the humble who respond to the word of the Lord, something like that. Again, I know I said not a full summary sentence and not a list of ideas, but if you say this story is about grace to the humble, grace to those who humble themselves before the word of the Lord, something like that. All right, that's the emphasis this reveals. That's the sermon you need to preach.